Who watches the watchmaker? Welcome back to My Seminary Life. I'm your host, Brandon Knight. This is Apologetics 201, the relationship between faith and science. And today we're definitely going to start shifting more into the scientific and faith realm as we discuss William Paley and his most famous illustration, the watchmaker. So for those of you unfamiliar with where we've been at on the show, this time last year during Apologetics 101, we did an episode called A Few Apologists You Should Know. Today we're going to zone in on one guy and one very important illustration that he used to argue for God being the chief person behind creation, and we're going to look at that today, but first let's get into the man. So, William Paley was a Cambridge student. He was the son of an Anglican vicar. He, for a season, was an Anglican priest himself and was also a professor there at Cambridge for a season as well. He wrote a couple different books, all within this realm of religion, science, and ethics as well. The one that we're going to be looking at today, because it's where the watchmaker illustration comes from, is from his book. It has a long title, so bear with me here. Natural Theology, or Evidence of the Existence and Attributes of a Deity. We'll just call it natural theology for short, just to keep things nice and simple. And in natural theology, he proposes the watchmaker illustration. So let's imagine that you're out for a hike. You're hiking along, going down the trail, and you notice a large rock on the side of the trail. And you pause to reflect on this rock. Where did this rock come from? Well, after you sit there or stand there and reflect upon where the rock came from, you may eventually arrive at the conclusion of, well, you know what? Maybe the rock has always been here. Maybe the rock wasn't, you know, rolled out here by the forest ranger or Yogi Bear or anything. This is, you know, maybe this boulder has always been here. Maybe somebody, you know, if it's like a rock, maybe someone kicked it down the road a little bit. But if, you know, it's just like a large boulder or something, maybe it's just has always been here. Now, let's say you're on that trail and you're hiking down a little bit further, and then in the middle of a trail is a pocket watch. Now, you would stand there and reflect upon where in the world this pocket watch came from, and you would probably arrive at the conclusion that this watch was either left, possibly dropped, by somebody who was passing through just like you are, right? The rock is, you know, in the environment. It's in an environment that makes sense. This watch, not so much, right? Somebody would have had to put that watch there or potentially drop it, whichever the case may be. This is not the native environment for watches, per se. Maybe upon further reflection, you get down there and you start fiddling around with the watch a little bit. You may come to realize that there's a very complicated mechanism within the watch of how the watch keeps time and continues to move and all that. Upon reflecting upon that, upon so many upons in this episode, when you get down and you start reflecting on the mechanisms within the watch, you may come to the conclusion that somebody had to have put those there as well. Whether the watch is running or not, the existence of the watch and the intricacies of the inside of the watch would lead to someone to conclude that somebody, something, had to have put this watch together. A watchmaker. from there, Paley then begins a series of logical statements that if the watchmaker has intelligence behind how they put the watch together, you know, the complicated mechanism within the watch implies some kind of intelligence in the watchmaker, that would then lead someone to conclude that the watchmaker has intelligence, right? If it's complicated, if the mechanism is complicated and it requires intelligence to put the watch together, I can't put the watch together, but I guess I have some form of intelligence. Maybe the comment section would maybe disagree, but I have some form of intelligence, but I can't put a watch together. But in the watchmaker illustration, intelligence implies that something or a somebody put that watch together. And if it is a somebody, intelligence in Paley's logical arguments would imply a person, not a thing, but a person. So we started with a watch in the middle of a hike. We've deduced that that is not the place where watches are usually found. The mechanisms within the watch lead us to believe that they were put there with intelligence. Paley would then argue that intelligence implies a person who put the watch together. Paley would then go further, because if you recall from the really long title of this book, that it's also attributes of deity. He would then work that logical statement out further to conclude that that person who put the watch together is also benevolent. Now, I don't know if you know this or not, but this is actually an argument for creation. I know your mind is blown right now, right? Yes, this illustration isn't to prove that all watchmakers are kind, loving people, but rather is an illustration that Paley proposes to argue for a term that we would use now, intelligent design, or a theistic benevolent creator. Benevolent being an important part of that situation. So just like how a watchmaker implies intelligence because of the complicated situation going on inside of a watch, when you step back and you look at creation and you see that there is a order and a mechanism to how creation works, even back in the 1800s when Paley is putting this together, like we had an idea that like it's not just, you know, we had an idea that the universe was complicated. You know, we were still figuring stuff out and we are still figuring stuff out. But even back then, we knew that the universe was complicated and that, but at the same time, like it wasn't random. Like it, there was a system that, you know, these things had to work in order for life and the universe to function and go on. You know, we would like to think that life finds a way, but it also helps that, you know, there's like this mechanism going on that like makes life possible. Paley would use the watchmaker argument, the watchmaker illustration, to apply to all of creation, that because there seems to be a mechanism going on and how all of this, whatever you look out your window, all of this works, implies intelligence. Somebody, something had to put all of this into order in order for it to work. Going further, Paley would again continue to work this logical statement out to say that it is a person, not a thing, but a person with intelligence, and that that person is benevolent, again, through a series of logical arguments. And this is how Paley would argue for, this theistic, benevolent creator within the universe. when you're talking about general revelation, whether it's Paley with this theistic benevolent creator or intelligent design, or even going back to Greek philosophy with the uncaused causer, we talked about that last year as well. When it comes to general revelation, you can only get so far. You cannot get to the point of Jesus dying for sins and your need for salvation. And arguably, as we're going to explore further here in a few minutes, but at a baseline, you really can't even necessarily get to the God of the Bible put all of this together either. A theistic understanding, maybe you can get to a theistic argument from general revelation. From nature, you can get to the conclusion that something, a God, put all of this into order, right? You can't get to the specifics. That's why we call it general. General revelation. We have a general idea that God, whatever that word means to you, put this all into order, but the God of the Bible, Jesus, well, that's, you know, we get that from special revelation, the Bible, right? General revelation, no matter how good your argument is only going to get you so far. Kind of sound like Karl Barth right now, but whatever. So the question then becomes, does the watchmaker illustration actually work? And the answer is not particularly. So here's the thing. As I spend time, you know, we're doing this stuff here on faith and science, and a lot of this is going to be focused on creation. You know, this is an argument for God creating everything. Next week, we have a whole episode looking at the various creation views that Christians often hold. And we're even going to have the live stream on YouTube where I'm reviewing Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, which is a movie about intelligent design, right? Like, and as we spend more and more time, as I spend more and more time researching and learning about all the different arguments, all the different ways that we try to understand creation, you know, Ken Ham is right and it applies to him as well. You weren't there. And because the account in Genesis 1 is more so concerned about God bringing order out of chaos rather than giving us an exact like timeline when all of this happened, I'm beginning to realize more and more that when it comes to this idea of creation, even if you want to have like a very like, you know, theistic evolution, like very like God and science approach to creation, the illustrations are going to fall apart at some point. They're, you know, it reminds me a lot of the conversation on the Trinity. You know, we did a whole episode about it like 2-3 years ago now about how, yeah, there's not actually a good illustration within the created world to explain the Trinity. It just, the Irish Trinity not kind of gets you there, but most illustrations, or at least most of the popular ones, they fall apart. They're actually heresy, like whatever whatever may be the case. And I'm starting to realize more and more that partially because we're trying to understand this through a very Western lens, a very creationism versus evolution lens, and not necessarily through like how Genesis 1, the purpose that Genesis 1 was written for. You know, Genesis 1 was not written to argue against evolution. Fun fact, not the point of Genesis 1. But because of this, like, I begin to realize more and more that we're just not going to have a full solution. Not to bury next week's episode, because next week, like I said, talking about creation theories, and this is a good thing for us to still just kind of understand these terms that people use. There's a word I've been using a lot in this episode that I'm going to eventually explain. But yeah, just to kind of like understand terms, it's still important to get at it. But I really think that in the end, they're all theories, and we're never going to actually arrive this side of heaven on how this actually all did work out. And I'm getting more and more comfortable with that. You know, back in November, Joe Day was on the show, and we talked about, you know, it was during the dialogue series, and this was, you know, common questions that people have. We did, him and I did creation, and, you know, we talked about how this notion of if you can't take Genesis 1 literally, then how can you believe the rest of the words of the Bible? You know, that just turns Genesis 1 into like this salvific thing. And you know what? You don't have to take Genesis 1 literally in order to be a born-again Christian. Like, that's not part of the requirement. You know, Jesus died for sins. And if you interpret Genesis 1 differently, that's not part of the equation when it comes to salvation. Yeah, I just... Anyway, so, is the Watchmaker illustration perfect? Let's get back to that for a second. That was a whole rabbit trail. And the answer is no. And to cut to the chase, a lot of this has to do with what you are arguing for. And I think this is going to bury my entire series right now, the downside to how we do apologetics. Because I think we take apologetics as like this either like quasi evangelism thing, or this like, I'm going to go out there and prove everybody wrong and win all these arguments. And it's like, I think when we come at it from that approach, we start to misunderstand like what apologetics is actually for, and, you know, to defend and persuade, right? But that doesn't mean like being this argumentative person, right? You're not picking fights. Maybe that's a better way to put it. You're not going around looking for fights. You're defending and persuading when you are challenged. But I think another downside to how we do this whole apologetics thing is that we don't start this conversation neutrally. Our goal is to get to Jesus. Our goal is to get to at least God, but ultimately Jesus and your need for salvation. Like, we have an end goal. And so we are going to learn how to do these arguments to get to the point of where we're trying to go, right? We look at this as a roadmap. A plus B equals C. We have a destination in mind. And maybe that's not the right way to do apologetics, is all I'm going to say here. But to be fair to us, even though we probably shouldn't be doing apologetics this way, I would say most people arguing for their perspective is going to start through their worldview, through their lens, with an end goal in mind. And for some people, that end goal is, you know, telling the other person that they're stupid, so, you know, they get there quicker. But I really think that part of the issue here, wherever this is headed next, don't worry, we are headed somewhere. I have an agenda too. But we, you know, that's actually the right word to use. We have an agenda, and maybe that's not the right way to do it. I'm not trying to say that the gospel is not important and we shouldn't share our faith. I'm just saying that if we're going to start with the end goal in mind, then we're going to interpret things around us in order to get. We're going to learn how to argue to get to that point. And other people do that too. Through their worldview, through their lens, they're going to be able to see the world and make arguments to get to their point. Maybe we need to do apologetics differently. Maybe that'll be apologetics 301, a different way to do apologetics. We'll have to see if we do that. Anyway, so is the Watchmaker illustration perfect? Not particularly. There's another guy who also went to Cambridge. Maybe you've heard of him. Charles Darwin wrote a book on the Origins of Species. Fun fact, actually was a big fan of William Paley. Also went to Cambridge, just like Paley. And apparently, I don't know how dorms work in the UK, but apparently he even like was like living on the same floor or maybe even the same room that Paley lived in when he was at Cambridge studying. So like total mark, total simp for Paley there for a while. But kind of turned away from how Paley saw the universe as he did his experiments and ultimately wrote On the Origin of Species and was able to see this evolutionary approach, this very simple definition for evolution, change over time, right? Now you may be thinking, wait, the Watchmaker illustration came out first and then the theory of evolution? It seems like that would be the other way around. Like we would have evolution and then Paley coming out saying, no, it's actually this. Another fun fact for you. Paley came up with the Watchmaker illustration to rebuttal the observations of Darwin's grandfather, who kind of got this ball started for what ultimately would be Charles Darwin's theory of evolution. Fun fact, just a whole big family British rivalry between the Darwins and the Paleys. I'm assuming they're all British here. Sorry if one of them's not. Anyway, so we have this whole idea of change over time is actually how all of this has come to be, not an intelligent designer putting everything into place. Another argument against the Watchmaker illustration is actually that word that I've used a lot, and no, not the word watchmaker or upon, but the word mechanism. And actually, mechanism is illustrated very well by two of my favorite writers, famed anarchist and warlock Alan Moore, and famed horror writer and racist H.P. Lovecraft. For those of you who don't know, and you could take my word for this as fact, Alan Moore wrote the greatest comic book series of all time called Watchmen. You may be familiar with it from your local geek, or maybe you saw the incredibly long movie by Zack Snyder starring a giant blue naked guy. And it's actually that giant blue naked guy, Dr. Manhattan, that I want to talk about. Because in Chapter 4 of Watchmen, The Watchmaker, Dr. Manhattan leaves Earth, goes to Mars, and begins contemplating existence and creation. And Alan Moore, again, is an anarchist, and Watchmen is this incredibly dense look at various worldviews, among other things. And Dr. Manhattan is to represent, at times, a very deistic understanding of the universe, where God has been with his people, had kind of put everything into motion, and then left. You see that here. Dr. Manhattan was among the people. Things went sour for him, and so he left. He is a distant god now. I mean, the guy's abilities include being able to vaporize people out of existence, and also is omnipresent and not bound by time. So basically God. And not only is he omnipresent and boundless, creates an entire civilization on Mars. And apparently it's later retconned that this universe that he creates is the New 52 universe. That part is irrelevant to this conversation. But you're probably sitting there thinking, but I thought you said this was a rebuttal. If this guy is basically God and he created a civilization on Mars, then isn't that actually fulfilling this argument? The creative, not only that, but Dr. Manhattan comes from a family of watchmakers. Alan Moore's being very on the nose here. What's interesting, though, is that this is actually a both and argument for mechanism and also a deistic understanding of creation, because Dr. Manhattan, as he reflects upon existence and creation, it's this long monologue in the chapter, he eventually concludes that the universe is a makerless mechanism. And then he proceeds to create a civilization. Is your head spinning yet? Just wait till I get to the H.P. Lovecraft part. But it's that word mechanism. Again, hold on to that word mechanism. So this idea here that Alan Moore is proposing is that there in the universe is running off of this already existing mechanism, right? Mechanism is a philosophical scientific worldview that there is an order to how things work. It's not random or chaotic. It's not absurd, like in other forms of literature would propose certain people who also wrote Alice in Wonderland. It's not absurd. There is an order. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's a maker. And within mechanism, you have this idea of eternalism. And eternalism is this idea that God and Bret Hart and the universe has always existed, is currently existing, and will always exist. So, I'll simplify this. Basically, what Alan Moore is saying here in Watchmen is that the universe has and always will exist based off of how the mechanisms are working. God exists within the somewhat eternal universe, because science is actually proving that the universe is winding down. God exists within within the universe that has the mechanisms. He did not put the mechanisms into place. He creates within the already self-sustaining mechanism of the universe. Which is interesting, especially since the Jewish understanding of Genesis 1 is that God brought order out of the chaos. Now let's go over to H.P. Lovecraft. So Lovecraft was a horror sci-fi writer of Pulp Fiction short stories there in the early 1900s. He is most known for the Cthulhu mythos. Ask your local nerd. They all know who Cthulhu is. It's this giant tentacle creature that kind of looks like the Kraken in the second Pirates of the Caribbean movie that lives at the bottom of the ocean and is one day going to devour everything. Like I said, horror stories. He created within his universe, not only within his stories, not only this like idea of a shared universe, because a lot of his stories are interconnected, even though they're not necessarily like Marvel Cinematic Universe, same characters, sometimes same characters, but not like MCU thing. But he created this thing that has come to be known as cosmicism, or the more easier thing to say, cosmic indifference. And again, it comes back to this idea of mechanism, but also mechanism materialism. Mechanism materialism, again, mechanism is this idea that the universe is like, it's not random, it's not chaotic, there's an order that is there. Doesn't mean there's a God, but there doesn't mean God put it there, but there is an order and that sustains everything. The materialism part isn't like a Madonna material girl thing. Have you appreciated all the pop culture references, by the way? Someone's screaming no. The mechanism materialism part is this philosophical view that this is the matter. Matter is a big part of how the universe is able to sustain itself and keep running. So within cosmic indifference, H.P. Lovecraft, who was very anti-religious, he proposes that cosmicism is a scientific philosophy that, I don't believe in God, I believe in science. It is a scientific philosophy that because the universe is just this like self-sustaining, always going thing, that means it doesn't care about you. That's the indifferent part. You know, there is no God in cosmic indifference. At least within Watchmen, there's this idea of kind of this both and. You have this both and kind of idea of like, yeah, it's all going, but God didn't necessarily put it all there, but he can create within it. With the cosmic indifference, you have this idea of it's just going. And because it's not a person, because it's not benevolent, because it's not anything that William Paley said it was. It doesn't care about you. Now, this is more of a literary philosophy that gets used in his various stories and all of his friends' stories and the multitudes of fan fiction that has been written inspired by Lovecraftian horror. But there is actually people out there who have tried to live out cosmic indifference. There is actually a tax-exempt Church of Cthulhu. Have a seat and catch your breath after that one. What's interesting, though, is that I have looked into these organized groups, their websites, their books, and they miss the whole point. Because within this Lovecraftian, this cosmic indifference idea is that if the universe doesn't care about you, then who gives a rip about morals? There is no moral absolute. Cosmic indifference actually lends itself to, one, a very nihilistic understanding of the universe, of what is the point then? Why am I even here? And also, morals are just dictated by culture. Morals is just dictated by, you know, society. It's rampant individualism. It's just care about yourself. Just be yourself. Not like in a hedonistic kind of way, but in a very like, just do your own thing. Don't worry about the people around you. And trust me, Lovecraft didn't care about people who weren't like him. I could tell you that much. And yeah, that's a skin color thing. That's a race thing. Didn't really care about other people. So, cosmic indifference, yeah, the universe is running. It's a mechanism. It's supposed to work that way. It doesn't give a rip about you because it's just a machine. So just do whatever you want. Live your life. The groups who try to live this way actually argue for like a very like love your neighbor, benevolent, fight for the poor and oppressed. And I'm like, why? If you truly believe that the universe doesn't care about you, then why are you holding yourself to a moral standard? Who cares? If the universe doesn't care, why should you care about other people? Just live. Just, you know, do what you need to do to sustain your own life. Maybe one day I'll write a whole thing about cosmic indifference. Anyway, so we have all these different views, right? We have William Paley saying, no. There is a mechanism. Everyone's, unless you go more of the evolutionary route, everyone's like, yeah, there's a mechanism. Evolution kind of like gets there over time. Everyone else kind of has this starting place of, yeah, there's a mechanism and it's working fine-ish. But Paley would argue that then says that God exists. Alan Moore, the anarchist warlock, would say, no, the mechanism exists and also God exists and can create within it. And then we have Lovecraft saying, it's just the mechanism. That's it. It's not that deep. Again, evolution is kind of like this other, kind of in its own like little category here of, yeah, there is a mechanism. We got to it over time. And in each case, I would say, this is just my opinion, people arrive at their conclusions because of where they started the race at. That's just me, though. Especially when it comes to H.P. Lovecraft, because very anti-religion, very scientific-minded. He probably would do really well nowadays. Not the racism part. That part would not work at all. But the like very pro-science stuff, that would really fly nowadays. Not the racism. Anyway, so is the Watchmaker illustration perfect? I think, again, if we're looking at apologetics as let's put our toolbox together of how to win an argument, sure, put it in the toolbox. Why not? I'm starting to think that maybe there's a better way to do apologetics than trying to make argument, trying to win arguments. But, like, sure, put it in the toolbox. I'm here to say, though, that I think this really does reveal that where you start is going to dictate where you finish. Maybe there's a better way to do apologetics than that. Maybe. But what do you think? Did I miss anything in my research? You let me know. Do you have a book on the watchmaker illustration? Should I read natural theology? Blah, 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 blah. Not to be disrespectful. It was just way too many words and I don't want to turn my head and read it. I'm lazy by nature. So let me know if I missed anything in my research. Drop in the comments, hit me up in my DMs, or send a message to email seminarylife@gmail.com. Seriously, I would love to be able to do a wee bit more research on this. It's quite fascinating. If you can't tell, I'm really into this. I'm really into this this subject. So let me know. That's it for today's episode. Hey, shout out to you, Lori, because you support the show monthly on buymeacoffee.com/MSLpod. Everybody who subscribes to the $9 a month tier, you could also be getting a shout out. So Lori, thanks for supporting the show. But you know what? Maybe a monthly support isn't something you can do right now. Good news, Buy Me a Coffee is actually more of a virtual tip jar where you can just leave a one-time donation, never think about it again until you hear me talk about it at the end of another episode. And any financial support towards the show is much appreciated because inflation. You can always go down to the link of this. You know, sometimes there's like rehearsed things that you're supposed to say, and those are always the things that I always mess up. I sit here and just kind of talk, and then when it's time to do the like rehearsed lines part, that's when I like totally drop the ball. If you ever need to find important links, Facebook, the website, the shop, the YouTube channel, you can go into the description of this episode, that's a word, and you can find all the important links there. I already told you what's coming out next week, looking at creation theories. This is going to get rowdy, let me tell you, folks. But until next time, this is Brandon signing off, reminding you, as always, that theology is for everyone, so keep on studying.